All right, so we're going to start here at the top of Chof Hei Amud Aleph. We're in the middle of the last Mishnah, which was comparing and contrasting Kli Cheres to other Kelim. And we noted that Kli Cheres has the unusual characteristic that it's Mitamei Me'aviro, that's in both directions, and both can contract Tuma through its Avir and also convey Tuma through its Avir. That's what's unique to the Kli Cheres. In addition, it's not Mekabel Tuma Migabo. It can't be Mekabel Tuma from the outside of the Kli. On the other hand, regular Kelim, all other Kelim besides the Kli Cheres are not able to contract Tuma or convey Tuma through their Avir, but they do, and they are able to contract Tuma Migabo. That's what we saw, that's what we established yesterday, and we established the fact that a Kli Cheres is Mekabel Tuma Miaviro. Now the Gemara is going to do what it did with every other Mishnah, is ask, why can't we apply whatever principle we know by one to the other? That's what we're doing at the top of Chof Hei Amud Aleph. Amalei Rav Adar Bar Ava LeRova, V'hei Kli Cheres Mitamei Migabo. Why can't a Kli Cheres accept Tuma from Migabo, Mikav V'chomer? Again, Mikav V'chomer either means literally a Kav V'chomer or a Mem Matzinu, as Tosot describes in other places. Uma, Kol HaKelim, all other Kelim, She'em Mitamei Me'aviran, they don't have this Chumrah, this special characteristic that they're able to accept Tuma through their Avir, Mitamei Migabam, yet they still are able to contract Tuma through the back of the Kli. Kli Cheres She'em Mitamei Me'aviro, that it does or is able to contract Tuma through Aviro, Einu din shitameh migabo? Certainly it should be able to have the tuma come into it migabo. So Amar Kra, here the Pasuk says, this is a Pasuk that's found in Parshat Chukat, in the Parsha of Tumata Meit. And there it says, V'chol kli patuach asher ein tzamid patil alav tamehu. Any kli that is not sealed on the top. Now tzamid and patil means that it has a cover, and tzamid means that it's sealed. So any kli that is not sealed on top, that kli will become tamei, and everything in it will become tamei. The implications are that if the kli is properly sealed on the top and covered, that it will not be able to be mekabel tuma even be'olam meit. And when we're not talking about olam meit, that means that tuma spreads everywhere into everything inside of there. So the Gemara says here, v'chol kli patuach hashen in tzamid patil alav, ezu kli shetumato kodemet lipitcho. Which is the kli that has this unique characteristic that it's tuma. Now the word kodemet does not here mean before, but rather in an expedient manner. Quickly. As soon as you remove its cover, it's able to contract tuma. So which kli is that? Davi Omer, ze kli cheres. All other kelim, when you open up the cover, the only way that it can have the tuma affect the kli is for it to actually be nogeya, to touch the inside of the kli. Other than by the kli cheres, as soon as it enters, the tuma enters into the airspace of the kli, it can contract tuma. So that's a whole kli patuach. Why is it called a kli patuach? It's a kli who is exposure, as soon as the petach is opened up, it has the largest form of exposure, and that's the kli cheres. That kli cheres, it says in the Torah, in Parshat Chukat, that if that kli cheres is covered and sealed, that it does not allow for tuma in the ohel meit to affect it. V'chi, ein tzamid patil alav hu detamei. Ha, the inference is, yesh tzamid patil alav, which we just said, tahor. It would be tahor. Now the only way for it to be tahor is if it's unable to contract tuma through gabo, from the outside of the kli. Since the only way for it to contract tuma is from the inside of the kli, and it has a seal on top of it and it's covered, then the only thing exposed in the olam meit, in the kli cheres, is the outside of the kli. The outside of the kli does not contract tuma, and that's why it would be protected in the olam meit. That would not be true by any other keli. Any other keli, even if it was covered, it would still be affected by the tuma in the olam meit, because it would get affected from gigabo, from its back. So the proof from this din, by tumata meit, and the olam meit, is that kli cheres does not contract tuma migabo. Even though you might have wanted to learn it, meme matzino, or kav v'chomer from other kelim, based on the din of the Torah, by the Olam Meit, it's clear that Kli Cheres cannot contract Tuma Migabo. Otherwise, it would not be Tahor in the Olam Meit. The only way for it to be Tahor in the Olam Meit is if it's protected on the outside and through the ceiling on the top. The Gemara now rejects and says that we can't say that a Kli Cheres will have Tuma Migabo. So now the Gemara is going to ask the other way around. Let's say, V'yu kol ha-kelim mitamim aviran mikal v'chomer. So the other way around. All other kelim should be able to accept Tuma through their avir from a kal v'chomer. Which we already just established, that a kli cheres is unable to contract tuma from the outside. Mitamei maviro, yet it does accept tuma, can and become tamei through the avir. Kol hakelim shemitamim migaban, all other kelim which have this chumrah or this additional factor where they do have tuma affect them migaban, then ain't no din shemitamim maviro, then certainly their internal part of the kli should be able to contract tuma, not just when it's touched, but even when it's in the airspace of the kli. So Amar Kra Tuchel. The pasuk says, and we saw this pasuk yesterday in Parshat Shmini, by the kli cheres, it says, v'chol kli cheres asher yipol mehem el tuchel. So there it's clearly the Torah is talking about kli cheres, and it says the word tocho. Tocho shel zeh, velo tocho shel acher. This is a unique din to the toch of a kli cheres, but applies to no other kelim. Where it says, vehani tocho ha darshinu. Wait a minute, where did you find the word tocho that you're able to be doresh? We lose the words tocho, both of them that are found in the pasuk in yesterday's daf, to explain how we know that a kli cheres accepts tuma and conveys tuma in its avir. Because one of the tochos is talking about how the kli becomes tameh, and the second tocho is that anything inside of it contracts tuma, it can convey tuma to other things in its avir. But that means we use both words tocho that are found in the pasuk already for a limud. So where do you have a tocho to teach you tocho of kli cheres velo tocho shel acher? You don't have an extra word tocho. So Mar says, arba'a tocho ktive. There are four times the word tocho is mentioned. Well, we know, I just read you the pasuk. There are only two words of tocho that are found in the pasuk. So Mar says, no, it's tocho toch, tocho toch. The Torah could have used the word toch in each of these instances. The fact that it used tocho gives us two limudim for each one of those words. Each of the words provides us with two limudim, because it could have written toch, and then that's one limud, the toch itself, and then tocho, the additional language of tocho, gives us the second limud. So that means that there are four limudim that are available to us in this pasuk. Chadugufe, one is to teach us the ikar din, that a kli cheres can accept tuma through its aviro. V'chadug zera shava, which is what I saw yesterday, just like it conveys tuma through its avir, it can accept tuma in its avir. V'chad tocho shel zeh v'lo tocho shel acher. One of them is to teach us this din that we just learned over here, that it's tocho shel zeh, meaning only kli cheres has the din of avir, no other kelim have that din. V'cha, the last one, which is a din we haven't bumped into yet, but we've seen in the past, which is tocho velo toch, tocho v'aflilu kli shetef matzil. And when it comes to the toch of a kli cheres, it's only true that when you're talking about the toch of a kli cheres, that it's able to convey tumat, whatever's inside of it, that's when we're talking about ochlim. When you're talking about foods and food items that are found inside of there or liquids. A keli that's found inside of there will not contract tuma. That's because the kli cheres itself can only be a rishon l'tuma. It came in contact with a avatuma, or a sheretz that went inside of it. If a sheretz is an avatuma, it makes the kli cheres a rishon l'tuma. Kelim don't accept tuma beyond that. So the kli cheres, it was conveying tuma, would convey tuma to the next level, which would be sheni l'tuma. Sheni l'tuma is not applicable to a kelim. Kelim only accept tuma from an avatuma. Directly from the sheretz, they cannot get it from the kli cheres. The kli cheres can only convey tuma to the food items that are found inside of it, not to kelim that are found inside of it. But the other din that we need to know here is that if you have a keli inside of another keli, so for instance, you have a kli cheres here, and inside of that you have a nice wooden vessel inside of it. Nevertheless, even if there's food inside the wooden vessel, that food would become tameh, because it shares a common airspace with the kli cheres. The kli cheres and the wooden utensil that are found inside of it share the same airspace, and therefore the tuma of the avir kli cheres will affect the items inside of the wooden kli. But if the wooden kli head or opening went above the mouth of the kli cheres, then it would protect whatever is found inside of it, because now they do not share a common airspace. The kli that's inside of it now acts as a barrier between the food that's inside of it and the avir of the kli cheres, and it protects what's inside of it. Now here the Gemara says, "Vafilu kli shetef matzil." Not only if it's a kli cheres inside. If it's a kli cheres inside, we know the din is that migabo, it does not mekabel tuma. So therefore, it can't become tamei from the avir of the kli cheres, and it'll protect whatever's inside that second or internal kli cheres. But the Gemara here says, va'afilu kli shetef. Now, kli shetef is a terminology that's used for any kli besides a kli cheres. The reason is because kli shetef refers to something that can be put in the mikveh, that can become tahor through the mikveh. In other words, shituf, shetef over here means to rinse, to cleanse, to cleanse. So any kli that can be tahor min hamikveh, which is anything besides the kli cheres, that is called a kli shetef. So here the Gemara says that a kli shetef can save that which is inside of it. Rashi says the chiddush here is that even though such a kli can contract tuma from the back and can become tamei, nevertheless it protects whatever is inside of it. That's what Rashi says the chiddush is. V'lo toch tocho, if there's another keli found inside of the kli cheres, if its rim or its mouth is below the mouth of the kli cheres, then it shares a common airspace with the kli cheres, and everything inside of it will come tamei. On the other hand, if its mouth extends above the mouth of the kli cheres, it protects whatever's inside of it. Because of this din, that the avi of the kli cheres only affects tocho, but not toch tocho. Not another internal space that's inside, it's protected. Again, one, because the tumah cannot be passed from the Kli Cheres to the other Keli. But more importantly, we have a Gzeret HaKatuv here that whatever is inside of that second Kli is protected from the Avir Kli Cheres. Those are the four Limudim that you learn out of Tocho. Again, two of them we did yesterday, which is that it can contract Tumah. Tumah can be given to the Kli Cheres through its Avir. Number two is that it can convey Tumah through its Avir. Number three is that only a Kli Cheres has a din of Avir and no other Kli. And the last din here is Tocho, that only things within the airspace of the Kli Cheres are Tameh, but lo Toch Tocho. If there's another Keli that separates or divides in there, it will not pass the Tumah from the Avir Kli Cheres. So now the Gemara attempts. Let's go the other way. Let's say all other kelim cannot contract Tumah from their outsides. Only from the insides. Okay, fine. It can't be that they have Tumah through Avir, because we know that's unique to a Kli Cheres. So let's say within their category where Nigiyah affects them, being touched affects them, let's say only touching the Kli on the inside affects it, but touching the Kli on the outside will not affect it. Mikav v'chomer. Umah Kli Cheres shemitamei ma'biro. Kli Cheres, which has this chumrah, that it's able to have Tumah be passed on to it in its Avir, eino mitameh migabot, yet it still does not contract, allow for Tumah to affect it from the outside. Kol kelim she'en mitameh ma'aviran, all the other kelim that don't have that chumrah, they only get Tumah through Negiyah, eino din she'en mitameh migabot, and certainly from the outside of the Kli, they should not contract Tumah even b'Negiyah. So Amar Kra, now we go back to that posuk in Parshat Chukat, says b'chol kli patuach asher ein samid patil alav tamehu. This is the opposite of what we have by the kli cheres, which is protected by the tamid patil. But here, when you have a kli patuach asher ein samid patil alav, then it's tamehu. So now the Gemara says on that, haihu, this kli cheres is the only item dechi ein samid patil alav tameh. That what causes it to be tameh? Because there's no cover on it. There's nothing covering the kli cheres, and that's what allows the tumah to enter into the airspace of the kli. Every other keli will not have to be open in order to contract Tumah. Well, how does it contract Tumah if it's not open? Only if it's able to contract Tumah from the outside, from the back of the keli. So the proof from that pasuk is that this is a unique aspect or unique characteristic of a kli cheres, that it does not contract Tumah from the outside, and therefore it's the only keli that you need to open it up in order for it to mekabel Tumah. Other kelim, if they remain sealed, they would still be mekabel Tumah. Ha, yesh samid patil alav, if it has a samid patil tahor. Ha kol kelim, any other keli, ben sheis tamid patilim aleihem, ben shein tamid patilim mitamim. It's irrelevant whether they're covered or not covered. The tumah will be able to access them, and the only way that could happen is if they contract tumah migaban. Therefore, we proved out that all the characteristics that we mentioned in the Mishnah, which are number one, that a kli cheres is mikabel and koveis tumah miaviro. Number two is that a kli cheres does not contract tumah migaban from the outside. And then number three is that any other keli has to have negiyah, only contracts tumah through touching, not through its airspace. And number four is that all other kelim are able to contract the tumah even from the outside, not just from the inside. Right now, move on to the next Mishnah, which deals also with kelim. And that is tahor bikli eitz. That which is tahor by kli eitz, tameh bikli matechot. It's problematic when it comes to metal kelim. Tahor bikli matechot, that which is fine by metallic kelim. It's problematic for a kli eitz. And as always, we have a brayta now to explain to us what that means. Tarabanan, golmei kli eitz. Golem is a formed item, but not finished. So over here, we're talking about golmei kli eitz are wooden utensils that are not completed. They have not been finished. They are tameim. They are able to come tameh because they have enough of a characteristic to be classified as a keli, and therefore they become tameh. Shutehem, flat pieces of wood are tehorim. Flat pieces of wood do not mekabel tumah, and that's because the din of tumah is learned out in Parshat Shmini. In Parshat Shmini, it says, mikol kli eitz, obeged or osak. Those three, all those four types of materials that are used, they're all compared to a sack. And the Gemara darshans are there, masak metaltel malei virekan. Just like a sack can be carried full and empty, meaning that it has a beit kibul. Also here, af kol mate malei rivekan. Also here, something that can be carried with items in it and out of it. So it requires a beit kibul. That's one of the requirements for the kelim, or to be classified as a keli, it has to have a beit kibul, it has to have an area that is a receptacle. So wood, kelim, are only mekabel tumah if they have a receptacle. If they're flat, they're not mekabel tumah. We discussed at the end of Nachot, when it came to the Shulchan, that there are certain exceptions to that rule on very, very big pieces of wood, and if they have certain usages for man and for other items, that we discussed, there was a sugya that we discussed at the end of Menachot. But the basic din is, pshutei kliyot, flat wooden kelim, are not mekabel tuma. Number two is, gomei kliyot, kelim of eight that are processed but not finished, they are classified as being, or able to be mekabel tuma. On the other hand, gomei kliyot matechot, metallic kelim that have not been finished, they've been worked on but not finished, formed and not finished, teorim, they are not mekabel tuma. On the other hand, pshutehem, tmeim, flat metal, flat pieces of metal are mekabel tuma. And that is because the difference between wood and metal is that the kelim of wood are found in Parshat Shmini, where they're compared to a sack. On the other hand, the kelim, the metallic kelim, are actually found in this week's Parsha by the Parsha of Midian. And in the Parsha of Midian, it tells us how you are metaher kelim. And over there, the Tarata kelim is talking about Zahav, Chesef, all metallic kelim. So since the metallic kelim are not compared to a sack, therefore they do not have this din of requiring a beit kibul or having a receptacle. That means even flat metallic kelim will be mekabel tuma. Nimtza. So that's what our Mishnah is teaching us. Tahor, big kliyets. That which is tahor by kliyets means flat wooden utensils which are tahor. Tamei bikli matechot. Or tamei by matechet, by metallic utensils, because the flat metallic utensils are mekabel tuma, because they're not compared to sak like the wooden kli is. Tahor bikli matechot. On the other hand, those which are tahor by metallic kelim, which is formed but not finished metallic kelim, are not mekabel tuma. They are tahor, they are tamei b'kliyetz. That same status by kliyetz, if they're formed but not finished, will be mekabel tumah. And now the Gemara lists, ve'elu hein gomei kliyetz. What is considered to be a golem of kliyetz? Now golem is something that is, golem has the general shape of the item, but it doesn't have the tzura. It's missing the finishing features of that kli. Kol, she'atid. Anything that has, still has remaining in the processing of the kli to do this. Lashuf. Lashuf means to sand it out or smooth it out. Lishabet. Shabet means to adorn it, to etch in the decorations into it. Ligarer. Ligarer is to plane it. Likarkov. Karkov means to trim it around or trim around it. Lehatiach betonis. Or to polish it with the skin of the tunny fish. Skin of tunny fish was like the equivalent, I guess, of some sandpaper. It was a very rough skin. They used that to polish the wood to give it a finished feeling. Now, it's true. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that a kliyetz is not even functional until you sand it. That's when we're talking about the large splinters. You have to at least get off the large splinters so it's still functional. That's a prerequisite for being a functional kli. But the other hand here, the polishing of the kli, that's a finishing touch. And it'll already be classified as a gomei kliyetz and mekabel tuma, even though you haven't done that finishing touch. Mechuser kan, if it's missing its base, o ogen, it's missing its rim, o ozen, or it's missing its handle, tamei. All of these items are tamei. These are all considered to be gomei kliyetz. They're formed enough to be classified as a kliyetz, even though they're not finished. These are finishing touches, and even absent these finishing touches, it's still classified as a kliyetz and is mekabel tuma. Mechuser chatita, on the other hand, if it's missing the hallowing out, the hallowed aspect of the kli, then it's tahor. So it's missing out the hallowed out aspect, then it's tahor, and the Gemara says pshita. Well, then what's it? It's not a kli anymore. We said one of the prerequisites of being kliyetz is it needs a beit kibul. So it has to be hollowed out in order for that to be the case. So if it's not hollowed out, then it's not a kli at all. So that Gemara says, pshita, chatita. Gemara says, lo, tricha, dechak kapiza bekapo. That he started to carve out, started to hollow out a stump of wood in order to make it into a kliyetz. His intent is to make it hold a kav. Kav is four log. His intent is to make it big enough to hold four log, but he's only gotten so far as to hollow it out for a kapiza, which is three log. So he's hollowed out three out of the four log that he intends. That is not considered to be a kli, because what he had in mind, he hasn't done. And since he hasn't done what he had in mind, he hasn't reached the point where this kli is functional for him. He wanted a kli that does four log, he only made a kli that does three log. So since it's not functional based on what he wants, therefore it's not mekabel tuma. The Gemara moves on to kli matechot. Ve'elehein gomei kli matechot. What are these formed but not finished metallic utensils? Kol shatid. Again, the same term that's used here. Lishuf, to smooth it out. Lishabet, to adorn it, to etch it. Ligarer is to plane it. Now over here, the girsa that we have in Rashi has the same girsa as likarker. Instead of likarkov that we had in the previous by the kliyetz, which is to trim it around, here likarker, as Rashi writes, bitsuyurim shekorim nail. It's some sort of images that are formed on it. And I don't know if the word there, nail or nail, is through some sharp edge that they use to engrave or etch the figures on it. Be'akish, be'kornus. It needs to be hammered out. If it somehow got crushed, it needs to be hammered out. Mechuser kan, it's missing a base. O ogen, it's missing its rim. O ozen, it's missing a handle. Tahor. All these cases, they're considered to be tahor, and that's what our Mishnah said. When it comes to gomei klemei techot, klemei techot that are formed but not finished are not classified to be kelim, and they're not mekabel tuma. On the other hand, mechusar kisui, missing its cover, then it's going to be tamei. The cover is a separate, considered to be a separate keli, and just because it's missing its cover doesn't mean that it's not a kli matechet and fully functional kli matechet. The Gemara says, maishnahani umaishnahani. What's the difference between gomei eitz that are mekabel tuma and gomei klemei techot that are not mekabel tuma? Why is there a differentiation between wood and metal? Rabbi Yochanan Amar hol v'lichvod asuyin. Because the kli matechot are made not just for their function, but also for their aesthetic. When it comes to kli eitz, they're simply made for their function. So as long as they can do what they're made to do, which is their function, then they already can be mekabel tuma, even though they're not finished, because the aesthetics aren't as important. When it comes to kli matechot, to metallic kelim, you do use metallic kelim not just simply for their function, but also for their aesthetic side to them. Because otherwise you could have made it out of wood, you could have made it out of another material. The fact that you use metal is because you believe that there's some value in the aesthetic side. If that's true, then just because it's functional does not make it a kli yet. It has to be both functional and aesthetic. So all the finishing touches will be important in making it into a kli, and will not be called a kli to be mekabel tuma until those finishing touches are put on it. That's Rabbi Yochanan's position. Nachan Amar ho d'mehem yakirim. Because they're very expensive. They're very expensive to make. Again, it's the same concept, the same idea, that if one invests the money to make kli matechot, then they're going to do it right. They're not just going to make them functional, they're going to make them aesthetic as well. And if the aesthetics are not completed, it's not a kli yet. The Gemara says, my binayu. What's the nafkamina between these two reasons? And the reasoning of Rav Nachman and the reasoning of Rabbi Yochanan. Ik binayu kli etzim. Has to do with utensils made out of bones. Va'azda Rav Nachman letamei. And we're going to see Rav Nachman is l'shitato. Da'amar Rav Nachman kli etzim kli matechot damu. Nachman says that a kli etzim, utensils made out of bone, have the same din as made out of matechet, made out of metal. So what's that mean? Because the difference between them is kli etzim, utensils are made out of bones, d'mehem yakarim, are very expensive. So since they're very expensive, Rav Nachman says that's the qualification for the din of matechet. So he compares kli etzim to kli matechot because they have the same characteristic, which is they're expensive. If they're expensive, you don't just skimp. You do the whole thing. You don't just make them functional. You make them functional, finished, formed, and aesthetic. So therefore, a kli etzim will be in the same category as kli matechot. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan, who said that the din has to do with their lichvod asuyin, they're made to use in places of kavod, they're used especially for their aesthetic side to them. So over there, he says that's true of kli matechot. Kli etzim are not that way. People don't make bone kelim to be used in places that of honor and special occasions. So therefore, according to Rabbi Yochanan, it'd have a din like kli etz. And if it's formed but not finished, the kli etzim would also be mekabel tuma. So now the Gemara says, michlau, the kli etzim mekabel tuma. The implication here is that kli etzim are mekabel tuma whatsoever. How do we know that bone utensils are mekabel tuma? The Gemara says, in, that's true, the tan you have a breita. Rabbi Shmuel, Benosh, Rabbi Yochanan, Ben Broko, Omer, Ma Talmud Omer. What does the pasuk say? That's this week's parsha we're about to read in Parshat Matot. It says, v'chol beged, v'chol kli or, v'chol ma'asei izim, v'chol kli eitz tit chatau. You have to be mitaher them. So over there, what is v'chol ma'asei izim? That's what Matam alo v'chol ma'asei izim tit chatau. Lavi davara ba mina izim. That's to bring something that comes from the izim, from goats. What keli comes from a goat? That's mina kornaim, from its horns, umin atalfaim, and from its hooves, from the hardened parts, the bone, the hardened parts of the animal, there you're able to form utensils. Shar behema v'chaya minayin. How do I know that this applies not just to izim? Because that's what's mentioned in the pasuk to goats. How do I know it applies to other animals? Tamalomer v'chol maseh. It says v'chol maseh izim. Not it's v'chol. There means any type, anything that's made from these types of materials. In came tamatomalomer izim. So then, why did the Torah specify izim? Then, if it meant all animals, but teach us prat lofot. Come to teach us, it's only true by behemoth. It's not true by birds. And Rashi notes over here that the griffin. It's a bird with large claws and nails, and they use those for utensils. They cut those claws off, and they use them for utensils. So those would not be classified as being tamei, as opposed to the kli etzem of behemoth that would be classified as being tamei. All right, the next Mishnah discusses, again, a similar type of format, which is, what is chayav b'masrot? Now, the Mishnah says, ha-chayav bishkedim, when we're talking about almonds, hamarim, bitter almonds, patur b'mitukim, is not chayav in masrot when it comes to sweet almonds. Hachayav in mitukim, that which is obligated in masrot when it comes to sweet almonds, Patur b'marim. It's patur when it comes to the bitter almonds. Tarumbanan. Shkedim hamarim ktanim. When it comes to bitter almonds, they're eaten when they are ktanim, when they're still small. When they get to be big, they're just too bitter to consume. So when they're small, they're still edible in that state. And therefore, they're chayavim in masrot at that point because they're considered to be an edible item. Gidolim, on the other hand, once they reach their full maturity, they are pturim. They are no longer chayavim masrot because they're not eaten. They're not a food anymore. They're not classified as a food because nobody eats them in that state. Mitukim, on the other hand, when it comes to sweet almonds, gidolim chayavim. When they reach full maturity, then they're sweet, they're edible and used as a food. So therefore, they're chayav and masrot. Kitanim, on the other hand, when they are yet to reach that stage of maturity, when they're in that immature state, they're not sweet enough. They're not really edible at that point, and therefore they are pturim. Therefore, they are patur from masrot because they're not really a food at that state. And that's what our Mishnah just said, that hachayav bishkedim amarim, that which is chayav by bitter almonds only chayav when they're small. They are patur b'mitukim. By small, sweet almonds, we said they are not chayavim b'masrot. And the other way around, chayav b'mitukim, that which is chayavim b'masrot by the sweet almonds, which means fully mature almonds, that is patur b'marim, does not work by the bitter almonds. Now we have an opinion which seems to disagree with above. Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, how to read this next stage of the Gemara. We'll read it according to Rashi first, which is, Mishmol b'Rabbi Yossi Omer, Mishum Aviv, ze v'ze liftur. Both of these are patur. V'amri lo, and some say, ze v'ze l'chiyuv. Both of them are chayav. The way Rashi reads this Gemara, this statement argues on a Mishnah, and along comes Rabbi Yoshua and says, ze v'ze liftur. They are both patur. Both patur means in their small state. When they are in their young, immature state, both the sweet almonds are patur from masrot, as well as the bitter almonds. None of them are considered edible at that point in time, and they are paturim the gamrei from maser. But amri lo, and some said it in this way, v'zeh zeh l'chiyuv. Both of them are chayav, meaning gdolim, that when they reach full maturity, both the sweet ones, which we know, are chayav in masrot, but even the bitter ones are chayav in masrot at the full maturity. Hora Rabbi Chanina b'tzibori, k'divri omer, zeh v'zeh liftor. And Tzipori, they pass like the one that says zeh v'zeh liftor. And now the main question is, Ulaman damar zeh v'zeh l'chiyuv, the one who says that they're both chiyuv, according to the way Rashi is learning, that means that fully mature almonds at that date, they're both chayav in masrot, then the bitter almonds, gedolim, the maichanzu, the bitter, large bitter almonds, what do you do with them? They're not edible. So Rabbi Yochanan hovi yochol matkana yedea or. You're able to sweeten them by putting them in the fire. If you roast the bitter almonds, they will become edible and sweet, and you'll be able to consume them, therefore they're chayav and masrot. So that's the way Rashi reads this as an argument being opposed to our Mishnah, which makes a distinction between big and small. Over here, we have Rabbi Shmuel says, no, that the din is consistent between the bitter and sweet almonds. When they're small, they're pturim. When they are large, they are chayavin. So that would be an argument or another opinion that argues on our Mishnah. Tosfot disagrees, and he says that Rashi's perush is dachuk ma'ot, very difficult to understand, and therefore he offers the alternative. V'zeh l'zeh liftor means perush marim, ben gedolim, ben tanim turim. That when it says zeh v'zeh liftor, it's coming to say that bitter almonds are never chayavin in masrot. The big ones because they're too bitter, and the small ones because they're too immature. They're just not edible because they're not mature enough yet. And the other opinion, which is zeh v'zeh l'chiyuv, is gedolim, because they have come reached full maturity. And the small ones, because the small bitter almonds, as we said before, are more edible than the large ones. Then the Gemara asks, well, what are you going to do with the large bitter almonds? You can't do anything with them. And that's what the matkan al yedei or, that they can be sweetened through the or. So according to Tosafot, the statement over here, Rabbi Shmuel, refers simply to the marim, only to the bitter almonds. And speaking about the bitter almonds, he either says both of them are pturim from masrot, or both of them are chayavim by masrot, both the big and small. Whereas Rashi is reading zeh v'zeh, referring to the sweet and the bitter almonds. Tosafot is reading zeh v'zeh, referring to the big and small, only in the bitter almonds. The next Mishnah requires a little bit of introduction. That's based on the Mishnayot in the Shkalim. The Mishnayot in Perek Aleph, at the end of Perek Aleph, the Mishnah Vav and Mishnah Zayin. It describes over there people who give the chatzi shekel. And there it also tells us an additional din, which is that a person is allowed to pay chatzi shekel for someone else. They're allowed to pay on their behalf. And it says, im shakal al yado v'ayad chaviro. Someone who pays the machatzit shekel for himself and for his friend is chayav b'kalbon echad. He has to bring a single kalbon. Rabbi Meir Amar, shnei kalbonot. He has to bring two kalbonot. We'll see at the end of the next Mishnah what this kalbon is. So the requirement is if you pay on behalf of someone else, you have to pay kalbon. Now, the kalbon, let's assume here, is used to break the coin down into two chatzi shekel. I mean, you'd have to pay the money changer. If you bring a full shekel up to the mikdash, they would have to return you a chatzi shekel in change. to break a shekel into two chatzi shekels, you have to pay the money changer. The amount you have to pay him is that kalbon. That kalbon is used to break the shekel into two chatzi shekel. Therefore, if you bring for yourself and your friend, both of you who are individually chayavin to bring chatzi shekel, and you bring it as a single shekel together now, you're costing the mikdash money because they have to split into two chatzi shekel. So therefore, you have to pay a kalbon along with your shekel that you bring to cover both of you. Now that's only true when you're paying for your friend and he's going to repay you. I mean that you're not doing it gratis. You're not paying for him without expectation of remuneration. On the other hand, if you look in the next Mishnah, in Zion it says, Shokela yedei ani, v'yadei shcheino, v'yadei ben iro. Someone who pays for a poor person, for his friend, or for his neighbor, for his one of his people in his city, patur, he doesn't have to bring a kalbon. V'im hilvam, if he lent them the money and he expects to get paid back, then chayav, he's got to pay a kalbon. The kalbon, we just explained according to the Chachamim, is to break the coin down. On the other hand, Rabbi Meir argues and says, shnei kalbonot, you have to pay two kalbonot. One impossibility explaining Rabbi Meir is that each one of you was chayav a chatzi shekel, and now you combine into a single shekel. So each one of you has to bring this kalbon to make up for that breaking of the coin. That's one way to understand Rabbi Meir versus the Chachamim. The other way to understand Rabbi Meir from the Chachamim is that Rabbi Meir's din of kalbon is different. He doesn't think that the kalbon there is to break the coin from a single shekel into two chatzi shekel, but rather to make sure that the chatzi shekel you're bringing today equals the chatzi shekel of Moshe Rabbeinu. The only way to do that is to bring a little extra. That little extra ensures whatever you're bringing is for sure the same size and the same weight as the chatzi shekel of Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, for every chatzi shekel, you're going to need a kalbon. That's the position of Rabbi Meir. What is this kalbon? So the Mishnah at the end of the Zion says, V'kamahu kalbon. How much is a kalbon? Ma'a kesef. Divi Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says ma'a kesef, which is 1/24. Of a shekel, and Chachamim Amrim Chetzi, half of that, 1/48 of a shekel. So that would be the amount that this kalbon is. What do they do with the kalbon? So it's actually a machloket in the Yerushalmi, it's machloket Tanaim in the Yerushalmi, what they did with the kalbon. One of them says that it went to the shkalim, according to Rabbi Meir, who says it's to fill in the missing part of the chatzi shekel, it went with them into the regular lishka, and it was used for the karbonot tzibur and all, so on and so forth, like the regular machatzita shekel. The other opinion says it to be used in order the ketza mizbeach. When the mizbeach was empty, they used to use the extra karbonot to fill in on the mizbeach. There's another Tana, Rabbi Shimon ben Zuri says, that they used to use it to plate the inside of the Kodesh HaKodeshim with the Kalbanot. And the last opinion is Rabbi Elezer, who says that that was the money that they paid to the Shulchanim. That's what it was used for. It was used to pay off the money changers in order to get the Shkalim split into Chatzi Shekel, or to pay the people who brought the Chatzi Shekel, whoever they hired to bring up all the Chatzi Shekel up to Yerushalayim. So it was used for compensation for those individuals who worked with the Chatzi Shekel. All right, that's the background to the Mishnah. I left out the one part of the Mishnah that's going to be quoted here in our Gemara, but that just gives you a broad perspective on what we're going to see here. Now the Mishnah says, Hatemed. Temed is when you pour water, according to Rashi, over the seeds of the grapes. And according to Tosafot, it's when you pour water over the shmarim, the sediment. So you pour the water over the sediment or the seeds of the grapes with the hope that it will pick up from the flavor of those grapes, and then it'll ferment and turn into a sort of wine. Ad shelo yachmit. Before it's fermented, einu nikach bekesef maser uposel et hamikveh. That, number one, you can't use kesef maser sheni to buy it. The Gemara in Erevin tells us that with kesef maser sheni, you can purchase food items to be eaten in Yerushalayim. Those food items have to be pre-mipri. They have to be something that reproduces. Produces vigduliarets and grown out of the ground. The exceptions the Mishnah says over there are melach and mayim. Salt and water do not qualify. So if something is classified as water, you cannot use maut maser sheni to purchase it. So over here, the temed that's poured over these items before it ferments has a classification of water. If it has a classification of water, you can't use maut maser sheni to purchase it. Now, uposelet a mikveh, by a mikveh that has yet to reach its 40 sa'ah, the standard of the mikveh, which is 40 sa'ah, if you put mayim she'uvim in there, if you put water that was drawn rather than rainwater into the mikveh, it's posel the mikveh b'shlosha lugim. Three lugim of mayim she'uvim end up in the mikveh, it's posel, but that's only with water. That's not true if it's some other juice or wine. So here, since this is classified as water, number one, you can't use it for ma'ot maser sheni. You can't purchase this as a food item with ma'ot maser sheni. And number two is, it is posel the mikveh. It'll ruin the mikveh because it's water that's going into the mikveh. On the other hand, once it's fermented, it has a classification of being wine. So therefore, nikach b'kesef maser sheni. You can use kesef maser sheni to purchase this because now it's a food item. No longer is it water. Veinu posel to mikveh. And it doesn't ruin the mikveh because it's wine and not water. So the problem is only shlosha mulgim mayim she'uvim. We'll see this in tomorrow's daf. It has to be drawn water of shlosha lugim before the mikveh reaches 40 sa'ah. Once it reaches 40 sa'ah, it doesn't affect it. But before it reaches 47, then the Shlosh Lugim and Mayim Shuvim will be problematic. But this is no longer Mayim. This is Yayin. This is classified as full-fledged Yayin at this point in time. The next part of the Mishnah, this is why I read you the Mishnayot from Shkalim. Ha'achim. Now, I'm going to read you the girsa that we have in our Mishnah. The girsa that we have in the Mishnah is Ha'achim Hashutafim. These are brothers that are partners. The Rambam's girsa in the Mishnah is Ha'achim V'Hashutafim. Brothers and partners. Meaning that there's the din applies to partners equally to brothers. I'll read it the way the girsa that we have, which is Ha'achim Hashutafim. You have brothers who are in business as partners. Kishi Chayavim B'Kalbon. If they're Chayav to pay the Kalbon, then they're Pturim Mimaser Be'ima. That they don't have to then pay Maser Be'ima. On the other hand, Kishchevim Maser Be'ima, if they have to pay Maser Be'ima, Turim in a Kabon, then they don't have to pay Kabon. Now what's the din? Maser Be'ima is only brought from animals that are owned by a single individual. Bringing every tenth animal is Maser, and to be brought up and eaten in Yerushalayim, that din of Maser only applies to animals that are a single ownership. Any animal that's owned in partnership, or there's monies that were put together in a partnership to work with that animal, they are Pturim Mimaser Be'ima, by a Kalbon. When it comes to the payment of that extra coin that comes along with the Machatzit HaShekel, we said before that if they are partners, then they are two separate individuals, or two separate individuals, each one has to bring a Machatzit HaShekel on his own, and since he has to bring a Machatzit HaShekel on his own, if they bring it together as a single shekel, they're going to have to pay the Kalbon. On the other hand, if they are considered to be a partnership where they're viewed as a single entity or a single person, then when they bring a shekel on behalf of both of them, then it's the entity that's giving the shekel, and we said in the Mishnah, if someone else gives a shekel, a chatzit shekel for someone else, when they don't expect remuneration for it, you don't have to bring a Kalbon. What are we talking about here? The case we're talking about here is where a father passes away. Father passed away, and the estate is left to the children. Question is, what happened to this estate? Did they divide the estate up and give it to each of the brothers? And then the brothers came back and formed a partnership. If they do that and formed a partnership afterwards, they are Pturim Mimaser Be'ima. Because now you have a partnership. Partnerships are Pturim Mimaser Be'ima. On the other hand, they are Chayavin and Kalbon. Each one of them is independently Chayav in Machatzit HaShekel. And if they bring a single shekel between them, they're going to have to pay the kalbon to break it up. On the other hand, if they never divided the estate, and the estate remains intact, that means that the estate now becomes as if it's a person. It's as if it's a corporate entity, the estate. And the corporate entity called the estate owns the animals, and is also paying the machatzit shekel. It's as if their father is still alive, quote unquote, because the estate is functioning as if the father is still alive. They haven't divided it up. Therefore, you're going to be chayavim in maser be'ima. Comes to maser be'ima, this is not considered a partnership. This is considered to be the corporate entity, the estate entity. It's as if their father still owns the animals, and therefore you're going to pay Maser Be'ima. On the other hand, when it comes to Kalbon, when it comes to paying of the Kalbon, you won't have to pay it. Because a father who pays Machatzit HaShekel for his children does not pay Kalbon. He's not obligated to pay Machatzit HaShekel for his children. So if he voluntarily does it, then you don't have to pay Kalbon. That's what we saw in the Mishnah. If you voluntarily do it, you don't have to pay Kalbon. So that's what the Gemara says here. They're mutually exclusive. If you're enough of a partnership to make you patur from Maser Be'ima, that means you're enough of a partnership, that means you already split the estate and rejoined, and that means you're a partnership, each one had to bring their own Machatzit HaShekel. On the other hand, if you're still within the estate, and you have the corporate entity of the estate, then you don't have to pay Kalbon, but that means you're also a single entity when it comes to Maser Be'ima, and you will have to pay Maser Be'ima. Now we'll just read quickly the beginning of the Gemara, and the rest of it will continue into tomorrow's daf. Mani Matnitan. Who's the author of our Mishnah? Lo Rabbi Yehuda, velo Rabbanon. Can't be Rabbi Yehuda and it can't be Rabbanan. Why? D'tanya, we have a braita. Hamitamed, someone who's making temed. V'natan mayim b'mida, u'matza k'dei midato. He pours water in, and what comes out is the same amount of water that he poured in. So what you assume now, if you pour water in, you get the same water out on the other side, is that nothing happened. There was nothing added to this water. This water is still the same water that went in, is now the water that came out on the other end. If it's k'dei midato, patur. Rabbi Yehuda mechayev. He still says that's chayav. Meaning that the chachamim, or the Tanakamo, believes that is considered to be mayim. Still water. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says that that's already considered to be peirot. Considered to be a peirot. It's considered to be gefen. And it'll be chayav in masrot. You can use maot masrot sheni to purchase it. It won't be posel the mikvah, all the dinim of yayin. But what do you see here from them is that nobody mentions the issue of machmitz, of the fermentation. Mani, who's the author of our Mishnah? Irabanon. According to the Rabbanon, afagav de ichmitz. To them, it's irrelevant whether it ferments or not. It doesn't ferment. To them, if the same amount that you put in comes in out the other end, that means that nothing happened. If nothing happened, then this is still water. So who cares if it fermented or didn't ferment? Whatever happened was we put water in, we got water out, that means it's still water. Irab Yehuda, if the Rabbi Yehuda is the author of our Mishnah, afagav de ichmitz. Rabbi Yehuda says, he doesn't say ichmitz matters. He says, if you put in water, you put it on the other end, then we know that it's considered to be wine because it went through this processing. So Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, the case is Kishichmit, Machloket. The Machloket between the Chachamim and Rabbi, which we just read in that Braita, is a case where it fermented. Rabbi will agree, when it doesn't ferment, if you put water in and you get water on the other end, it doesn't ferment, nothing happened. Even Rabbi will agree to that. The question is, if it does ferment, did something happen? According to Rabbi, if it ferments, that indicates that something got in there. Some wine got in there, and now we have not water, but we have wine. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe, no, if you put water in, you get the same amount out. Even if it ferments, that fermentation, as Tosfos called it, is kiyua b'almahu. It's not really juice. It's not really yain that's in there. It's the acidic effect, or the acidic effect of the items that it passed through, whether it's the shmarim, the sediment, or the seeds, that cause it to ferment, but there's nothing really changed. It's still water, even though it's fermenting at this point in time. So that's machloket. Umat nitin. Then who's the author of our Mishnah? The author of our Mishnah is going to be Rabbi Yehuda. Because Rabbi Yehuda says that im hechmit, if it does ferment, then it's classified as wine. If it doesn't ferment, then it's classified as water. So our Mishnah, we're talking about a case where you put a set amount of water in, the same amount of water comes out the other end. And Rabbi Yehuda says, well, if that ferments, it has a din of yain. If it doesn't ferment, it has a din of maim, of water. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda will be off the Mishnah. Chenam Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chinina, Shehechmit. Machloket, the machloket between Rabbi and the Chachamim is only once it's fermented. Everybody agrees if it didn't ferment that it's not classified as wine. Even there, if you pour in an amount of water and the same amount of water comes out the other end. The implications from this are, if you do pour in water and more comes out the other end, that everybody agree that that is classified as being wine, even if it does not ferment. If it comes out, the equal amount of water comes out the other end, then fermentation matters. But if you put in 3 log of mayim and 4 log show up on the other end, it's clear that we don't have water on the other end now because it picked up something from whatever was inside the chartzanim or the shmarim. So there it's clear that it's yayin. The only question that arises when the exact same amount that you put in comes out, there it's unclear if something happened. So then we need fermentation, according to Yehuda, to prove that something happened. If there's no fermentation, then nothing happened. According to Chachamim, it's irrelevant. Doesn't matter if it ferments or doesn't ferment, nothing happened, because you got the same amount of water out the other end. Tosfos points out over here that even b'shechmitz doesn't mean that it literally has to ferment. It just means that it has to have the potential to ferment. Doesn't mean that it already fermented. It just means that it can ferment. If it can ferment, then it's yayin already. From that moment, it's yayin. It doesn't have to actually ferment for it to be classified as wine. As long as it has the potential to ferment, that was what classifies it as wine. And it'll be considered a full-fledged wine, according to Rabbi Yehuda, which means you can make Bari Pir Gofen on it, you can make Kiddush on it, and so on and so forth, and have the full classification of wine. Okay, we'll stop over here, and we'll continue with this Gemara tomorrow.